the closing argument that my whole life depended on was so generic and bland. I mean, it put me to sleep.
Actual Innocence is a podcast that tells the story of people who served time for crimes they did not commit. Hear the heartbreaking, true accounts of those who have been wrongly convicted and then are proven innocent. Thanks for joining us.
Greg Taylor awaited a trial for over a year. His second paid attorney used a no-defense strategy and assured Greg that the jurors would see through the weak case of the prosecution. When it was time for his attorney to stand up and defend Greg, the results were not what he was expecting.
I was convicted on Monday, April 19th, and the Friday before that, it was kind of an off day in court. The jury had the day off, and really all they did was get the ruling on the motion to dismiss. Because my attorney had to take the day off and give a speech or something in chapel. Saturday, my wife and I, you know, were thinking, you know, it would be nice if we heard this closing argument before Monday. It was funny. It was like, I don't want to make him mad. I was telling my wife, I said, but if you call him, maybe he won't tell me. So she called my attorney, and after she hung up, she looks at me. She says, he said he was busy working in his yard and he would see us in court on Monday.
This is the closing argument that Greg's attorney had declared was the most important part of his case. It was the reason that no evidence was presented by the defense, so that he would be able to have the last word.
And he threw the truth away, based his whole case on a closing argument, would not even present the closing argument to me before he presented it to the jury. And then when I heard it, and like my wife says, it sounded suspiciously like a speech somebody might give to a law school. He started out by saying something about this tapestry. And again, you have an option in North Carolina back then, whether or not you want your closing argument recorded. And he didn't want it recorded. It's not part of the record. So the best I remember is that it started out with something about a tapestry, which I think he was implying, or he was trying to describe how the system is kind of woven together of different parts, and, you know, defense attorneys have their part, and judges have their part, and jurors have their part, and he lost me, and I couldn't follow it, you know, despite, obviously, if my life depended on it, and the jury, I guess, couldn't follow it either. After the closing arguments, when my attorney's talking about tapestry and the prosecutor is pounding to the jury 17 times, the victim's blood's on my vehicle, and they came back in less than 2 hours. All this was enough for the jury, and they came back, and I guess just to make sure they covered all the bases, voted me guilty for first-degree murder. The verdict was a shock. The judge sentenced me to the rest of my natural life in prison. I was led to prison that evening for day one of 6,149.
After 6,149 days in prison as an innocent man, I asked Greg if he could describe the prison experience.
How would I describe it? Well, the way I did my time was I just tried to be invisible. And I just felt like I was dropped in from another planet. I didn't understand officers or staff. I didn't understand inmates. I don't understand criminal behavior. I just wanted to be as far away from it all as I possibly could. I didn't want any trouble. All I wanted to do was to go home. And that was all I ever wanted from the first minute I stepped into prison. And so I tried to distance myself from everybody, stay out of trouble. You try to, you know, in the end I had some, you know, realizations that maybe I could use this as an opportunity to, you know, to better myself or whatever. So I mean, but I was rehabilitated after the first meal, so I really don't know why I was in there for the other 6,148 days. But anyway, I earned a couple of college degrees in electronic engineering and computer technology, and I had a technical diploma in industrial electricity and a handful of certificates and stuff. So I spent about 5 years in school and earned those degrees and whatnot. And then I became a teacher's aide for a couple of years. And then I went to another camp and was a library clerk for almost 10 years. No infractions, which is like, you know, you have an extra pair of socks, that could be an infraction. And I never really thought about it, but after about like 5 or 6 years, you know, somebody was asking me, well, how many infractions do you have? I said, well, I don't have any. And they kind of look at me like, really?
There are three classes of infractions, according to the Department of Corrections, with class one being the most severe type of infraction, including assault, battery, and escape. Class 2 infractions are less severe and includes destruction of property or disobeying a direct order. And the third class includes minor offenses such as lying to an employee or possession of contraband, such as an extra pair of socks.
The way I handled myself was I'm very nearsighted. My dad would come to visit me one time and he said, son, he says, why don't you get some glasses? And I said, Dad, I said, I can see how to read, and anything past 6 feet is none of my business. Really nothing I wanted to see, you know what I'm saying? And I think what ended up happening was people got to know me and realized that I'm not a threat either way to them. You know, I'm not going to rat them out, or I'm not going to compete with their hustles or whatever. And so they let me alone, because if somebody else is on my bunk, it might be somebody that they have to deal with. I was just like filling up this void that could have been filled up by somebody worse. So I just went about my business and gave everybody as much respect and leeway as it was within reason. And I just, you know, I would work out. I would do my little library job, and I would read and, you know, listen to the radio or something, and I just stayed to myself. And I think one of those things, one of those reasons, is because this guy that made this story up, I never even spoke to. I don't know what he was like as a person or anything. So I just kind of felt like any of these guys could have been him. There was nothing I had to say to anybody. People think that, you know, prison is all about everybody there saying, I didn't do it, I didn't do it, I didn't do it. But when, for the most part, nobody says anything, they just go about their business. And, you know, and it never made sense to me is, why am I going to stand up and try to, I mean, obviously the system gets it right more time than it gets it wrong. They get it right. So why am I going to try to make myself look like the 2 or 3%? You know, so people just don't say anything. They just go on about their daily routines and do their time and go home. But the hard part about it was there was no end in sight. And, you know, and all I had was the truth, and that didn't mean anything. And I lost everything. And all I could do was, you know, just fight my case, no matter how futile that was. So that's what I did.
While Greg was in prison, the rest of his family still had lives on the outside. His wife, his parents, and his daughter had to move forward, even though Greg was not able to be there with them.
Those barriers are the same whether or not you're innocent or guilty. And those barriers make it impossible to sustain any sort of relationship in a meaningful way. And so you lose. I mean, there were people I've known, you know, since I was 4 or 5 years old, and at first, you know, the letters are there and the occasional visit or whatever, but then after 5 years, pretty much just all that stopped. My wife left after about a year. I would say all except for, you know, like my mom and stepdad and dad and brother, sister, you know, and their support was phenomenal. You know, they would come up every week and visit me, whether I wanted to visit or not, because there was, for a long time, I really felt like that I didn't want this to be any more of a burden on them and that they should just go on about their lives and, you know, just leave me to deal with it. Yeah, so they came up there and suffered right along with me, and did everything, you know, in their power and then some. You know, the private investigators, attorneys, you know, whatever. My brother became an expert on dealing with attorneys and, you know, and arguing facts and you know, learning the evolving sciences and, you know, legal precedents and stuff. And they always, you know, they kept money in my account so that I, you know, could go to the canteen or whatever and get a little food or whatever. And so all these years, I probably only missed maybe 5 or 6 visits.
The divorce rate among couples where one spouse is incarcerated for 1 year or more is 80% for men and close to 100% for women.
After I was convicted, my attorney, my trial attorney, came to see me at prison the next day. You know, and he told me, he said, Greg, he said, you should not be in here. He said, it's going to take 12 months at least and 15 months at most before the North Carolina Supreme Court will overturn it. So the first step in the process was my direct appeal to the North Carolina Supreme Court. And as an adjunct to the whole process, there was also this other factor, which was my co-defender. Remember him? He was in jail. Before my attorney left the courtroom the day I was convicted, the prosecutor and judge approached him and said that they would help getting my sentence commuted if I would testify against my co-defendant. And I said, well, I can't do that. I said, I know he's as innocent as I am, and I just don't have anything to say against the guy. About 3 months go by, and my co-defendant is still in jail. And he writes the newspaper, basically says they're holding me hostage. How they convicted Taylor is mind-boggling, is what the word that he used. And then he goes on to say, if they think they can convict me, they need to carry me to trial. Otherwise, they need to drop the charges, one. He said, I'm just sitting here. I'm losing everything. My family, you know, bills are piling, you know, and all this. And he said, they need to do something. So what they did was they wrote me a letter, the prosecutor did, and said that if I testified truthfully against my co-defendant, that they would commute my sentence. And so I wrote him back, and I said, I will testify truthfully. I said, you can give me hypnosis, a polygraph, truth serum, and I'll prove to you that what I'm saying is true with your own evidence, and that's what I'll testify to. So he wrote back and said that was unacceptable. And he dropped the charges on my co-defendant.
On September 26th, 1991, Johnny Beck, Greg's co-defendant, was arrested for the murder of Jackie Thomas. On October 14th, 1991, the Wake County Grand Jury indicted Beck for the murder. On August 18th, 1993, Assistant District Attorney R. Thomas Ford, the same prosecutor who prosecuted Greg, voluntarily dismissed the murder charges against Beck.
So for anybody who's listening to this, who might have, you know, as much as a person can have a belief in the system, you've got two people who insist they were together the whole time in question, and both are arrested for first-degree murder, and both are thrown in jail with no bond, but the charges are dropped on one, and the other one goes to prison for the rest of their life. Now, which way did the system get that right? Because it could not have been right both times. The reason why the charges were dropped, according to the prosecutor, what he wrote on my co-defendant's dismissal paper, was this defendant did not make incriminating statements to a jailhouse witness. And when I read that, I said, well, this defendant did not either. And I set about to prove it. So I requested through my family that they get me the trial transcript, the statement of the jailhouse liar, and copies of every newspaper article that was out at the time of my arrest. The jailhouse witness said that I told him that the victim had been run over. The newspaper reported the police's theory that the victim had been run over with the truck. And the autopsy came back a couple of months later and explicitly said there is no evidence that the victim had been struck by the vehicle. So that meant there was only two places that could have possibly mentioned it was tied together, that jailhouse liar and the newspaper. If we were guilty, then I would have been conveying to him something that wasn't true. So I tied him to the newspaper. I tied him saying that I told him something and that fact only came out of the newspaper. And so, of course, that didn't mean anything because in the way the appellate process works, and this is what I did not know, and what this is when the depression hit, that I didn't think an innocent person could be convicted, and then I certainly never thought an innocent person would not be let out on appeal. But then I find out that the appellate process is all about procedure. It's not about guilt or innocence, that was supposedly decided by the jury.
I was curious about how the appeals process works, and so I visited the North Carolina Department of Justice website to see what information I could find. The process starts with an official transcript from a court reporter who has up to 4 months to prepare this document. The transcript is then sent to the defendant's appellate attorney, who has 35 days to prepare a document called the Record on Appeal, which lists the errors that kept the defendant from getting a fair trial or sentence. The Record on Appeal is then served to the prosecutor who handled the original trial. That person has three options: agree, object, or add information. This must be done within 21 days for a non-capital case. Once the two attorneys agree on the record, sometimes with the assistance of a judge, they must file it with the proper appellate court. The Attorney General's office then assigns an appellate lawyer who will investigate the claim. The defendant has 30 days to file a brief, basically a written legal argument, about the errors mentioned in the Record on Appeal. The state then has 30 days to file another brief in response to that. Non-capital cases go to the North Carolina Court of Appeals and are heard by three judge panels.
And so there's outside of the direct appeal, which it was about trial procedure, the only way I could get back into court was through ineffective assistance of counsel, prosecutorial misconduct, or new evidence. And new evidence is what I was screaming left and right, because there was never any defense presented, so there was all sorts of things the jury never heard, which I would think in a court would be considered new, but that's not the way they look at it. New evidence is evidence that could not have been discovered at the time of trial, and my attorney could have discovered that this jailhouse liar quoted the newspaper and said it was me that told him that. And the other thing was the jury never heard from the woman that picked us up. The police found this woman and interviewed her. And this is like 3:30 in the morning when this woman is driving by. And my co-defendant and I, we were like, well, you know, we need a ride. We'll try to wave one down as we walk to a phone. And if we don't have a ride by the time we walk to a phone, then we'll call a cab. Luck would have it, this car rides by, and we just kind of wave, and this woman stops. And, you know, she considered us not, you know, not a threat. And we get in the car. And, yeah, so she rides us around, you know, like for a couple of hours. We go out partying and stuff, and about sunrise, she drops my co-defendant off and then drops me off at a payphone, and I call my wife. So anyway, the police find this woman, and she says that we were clean, that we weren't carrying anything, and that we acted like two people whose car had broke down. Jury never heard that, and which, to make it worse, as my attorney was questioning the arresting detective, there was a recess, and my wife asked the attorney, why aren't you, and the woman's name was Barbara, why aren't you asking this detective about Barbara? And my attorney looks at her and says, they never found her. And my wife says, what do you mean they never found her? I was just reading her statement last night. And my attorney says, you have a copy of it? And my wife said, yes. And so my father-in-law did one of these Perry Mason things. You know, he drives to my house and gets the statement off of that desk and comes back in the courtroom and gives it to my attorney. And my attorney tries to question the detective about it three times, and it was objected to because of hearsay. You know, so how could he prepare? You know, that's another thing, too. It's like, okay, you have a strategy about not presenting any defense, but shouldn't you prepare a defense before you decide whether or not it's better to present it or not? And he never apparently saw that statement from this woman that that gave us a ride and that the police found. You would think somewhere somebody would have been able to hear that in a regular court of law, but it can't be. Prosecutorial misconduct is very, very, very difficult to prove, just as is ineffective assistance of counsel. New evidence, of course, has to be something that could not have been discovered at the time of the trial. And so that was a moot issue as well, because all that stuff could have been discovered. And indeed, I mean, the statement was right there, so it had been discovered. It just was never read.
I told Greg that it sounded like his attorney was not very effective, and I asked him if he had considered using the ineffective assistance of counsel avenue of appeal.
Ineffective assistance of counsel, I read in one law journal, it says if you can hold a mirror up to the attorney and it fogs, then that means he or she's effective. And that's about the size of it. So you have to pass what's known as, I think it's Strickland versus Washington, and there's like a two-prong test, and they've got so many ways of rendering that law meaningless that it's unbelievable. It's, especially when you get up to the Fourth Circuit here, Fourth Circuit Federal Court, which upholds like some astronomical percent of appeals compared to the rest of the country. So anyway, I was dealing with still a very high burden in ineffective assistance of counsel, and one of the ways that it becomes so high is because you have strategy and tactics so that an attorney can get on the stand and say, hey, you know, it was my strategy. If my strategy didn't work, so be it. But that was what I planned to do. And that's all an attorney has to say, essentially. So, and that's what my attorney did. He said, that was my strategy. So the motion for appropriate relief failed. And in 1996, I was basically forced to go ahead and pursue motion for appropriate relief because Timothy McVeigh bombed that building in Oklahoma, and President Clinton came out with the Anti-Terrorism Death Penalty Act, which shut the door on prisoners to habeas corpus after a certain time, unless they had stopped the clock with some other proceeding. So basically I had until, I think it was like April of 97 or something, to get into court one way or another. So I had to file a motion for appropriate relief before I could pursue habeas corpus. And the motion for appropriate relief is state level, and habeas corpus is federal level. So you have to exhaust, you know, your state remedies, basically. This is the way it worked at the time in North Carolina, I guess. I don't know, maybe everywhere.
A motion for appropriate relief is basically a motion that lets people challenge their conviction because the conviction was obtained in violation of their constitutional rights.
The motion for appropriate relief, as they called it, is based on one of those three things I mentioned previously, the prosecutorial misconduct, ineffective assistance of counsel, or new evidence. And so we pursued ineffective assistance of counsel and was turned down. And in North Carolina is the only state, I believe, in the union where they let the prosecutor set the calendar. And so the prosecutor can basically shop for the judge that he wants. And if he's got a case that he believes is kind of iffy as to whether or not it'll go to a jury, he'll wait around for a judge who has a reputation of siding with him. And that's what he did. So my direct appeal, I felt pretty good about because, you know, my wife was really working hard on that. And, you know, we knew the case inside and out, and, you know, and we believed, and the direct appeal was going to have to be based on the fact that the motion to dismiss did not succeed. So that gave us a chance to argue, you know, the lack of evidence. The Attorney General's office, in arguing against that, came up with this extra bit of the fifth piece of what I call the fifth piece of evidence, which is that there was no way I could have known that the victim's throat was cut unless I was a direct participant in the crime. And so what this all came about from was the police, Detective Howard, showed me a picture of the victim from the shoulders up and puts this picture in my face and says, "This woman died a horrible death. Somebody's going to pay a hell of a price." And he's just sitting there holding that picture and not saying anything else. And I'm looking at the picture and there's all this blood about the neck area. And I was like, well, how did she die? Did somebody cut her throat? And so by the time this goes on to appeal, the Attorney General's office is arguing there's no way I could have known the throat was cut unless I was a participant in the crime.
It sounded to me like Greg was being accused of being observant.
Okay, well, I wasn't being observant because the autopsy explicitly says that the victim's throat was not cut. Okay, so I made a guess based on what I saw, and the guess was wrong. But they say that was a privileged knowledge, that the only way I could have known the throat was cut is if I was a participant in the crime. But the throat was not cut, according to the autopsy. The autopsy describes a severe and crushing wound to the neck, which left a 1.5-inch gaping hole and was so severe that it crushed the vertebra in the back of the neck. So that was what I saw and asked if the throat was cut. The North Carolina Supreme Court said that's enough to keep him in. Yeah. Actually, what the judge said was, if I see a reason to keep him in, then this is it. Yeah, so they kept me in. And they kept me in. I pursued the ineffective assistance of counsel for no avail. And through habeas corpus, got a chance to argue the dog one more time.
I couldn't remember what habeas corpus meant, though I feel like I should have learned about it in fourth grade social studies. Sorry, Mrs. Russell. So I asked a friend who is a paralegal. She said it's when a conviction has been upheld on appeal and the person feels like their constitutional rights have been denied. Most people who use this defense either believe that they were a victim of prosecutorial misconduct, ineffective assistance of counsel, or there is evidence of actual innocence. Or, in simpler terms, it's like when the state is screwing you, you let the feds look at it.
Yeah, that was basically they came back and said the dog was trained. That's all the law requires. And I came back and said, well, my dog was trained to sit and fetch. You know? So couldn't I take my dog out there and let him run around and come back and say he didn't smell anything? You know, the way the law is written, it would seem to me like that could have done. You know, they did. They ran five dogs down there looking for that murder weapon and never found anything. And they have a very reliable witness with nothing to gain or lose. It said we weren't carrying anything when she picked us up, and it's probably pretty obvious at 3:30 in the morning this lone girl is not going to pick anybody up wielding some sort of a blunt force weapon, right? She was never heard from again until 2010 when she testified for the first time at my hearing. But it was very dismal for a long time. In 2001, my U.S. Supreme Court appeal was denied, and at that point, we didn't know what to do.
Imagine sitting in prison for a crime you did not commit, and time again, getting violated by the justice system designed to protect you. What do you do?
My dad hired an attorney out of Greensboro, his town of residence, and this attorney was going to be to pursue clemency or a pardon of some kind. But one of the things that had been going on through the years is this DNA testing I've been reading about in the paper. So why can't I have DNA testing? You know, take all this stuff from the victim, myself, my co-defendant, test it, and we'll share the results with the prosecution. I don't have anything to hide. My family will even pay for the test. So my attorney filed a motion in Wake County Superior Court for DNA testing, and along those lines, you know, we'll pay for it, we'll share with the prosecution. Just please allow us the DNA testing.
DNA is a set of unique instructions that's been passed to you from your ancestors. It's the building blocks of each of your cells and is left behind almost everywhere you go in some form or another. DNA testing is the testing of cells to determine who has left these particular cells behind.
The motion was denied without a hearing. So I was denied DNA testing, and that was my last chance in court. And that was when I seriously had to look at dying in prison. That was in 2003.
Once a middle-class family man, Greg was now an inmate who appeared doomed to spend the rest of his natural life in prison.
You know, what do you do after that? I wrote a letter, and I had written so many letters over the years, but I wrote a particular letter to the North Carolina Center on Actual Innocence, which is a nonprofit that kind of works up under the National Innocence Project or National Innocence Network. The North Carolina Center on Actual Innocence oversees innocence projects at law schools, and they receive claims of innocence and will look at case files and things like that. They don't have any subpoena power, or they can't really get it, prosecutor files and things like that. I mean, I guess they could ask, but they're not legally obligated to receive any of that kind of stuff. But nevertheless, they have these, you know, energetic, very bright law students that, you know, look at the transcripts and things like that, and they'll go back and interview witnesses and do everything that they can to determine guilt or innocence and hopefully be able to prove innocence.
According to the North Carolina Center for Actual Innocence, over 600 inmates submit innocence claims to the center each year, and all of the applicants are indigent and underrepresented.
So my letter turned into an application of, like, I think it's about a 17-page application that they were receiving about 900 applications a year at the time. And my application, you know, sat in a stack down there for about a year. And during that time, there was some movement in North Carolina because of some high-profile exonerations that had taken place. And North Carolina formed what they called, I think it was called the Actual Innocence Commission, to study the causation issues of wrongful convictions.
The North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission is a state agency established in 2006 by the General Assembly to investigate and evaluate post-conviction claims of factual innocence. The commission is made up of 8 members selected by the Chief Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court and the Chief Judge of the North Carolina Court of Appeals. The members include a Superior Court Judge, a prosecuting attorney, a defense attorney, a victim advocate, a member of the public, a sheriff, and two discretionary members.
One particular exoneration was Daryl Hunt, who just passed away recently, but he had filed, I think it was 11 post-conviction motions claiming innocence that were all denied. And this commission wanted to know how, and he was exonerated by DNA, and they found the person who did commit the crime. So it was one of those complete closure kind of exonerations. And so the actual Innocence Commission wants to know, how can a person who's innocent be turned down 11 times in the regular process? Something's missing there. And so they started looking at that, and I say it's directly because of all Daryl's case, but it's probably just in general. And the Chris Muma, the lady behind, who's the force behind it all, her and Chief Justice I. Beverly Lake were very instrumental in starting a movement to form what became the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission. Chris Muma is the director of the North Carolina Center on Actual Innocence, where I had filed my application. She's also, the work of the center also involves reform, and so along those lines, you know, she was lobbying to for this North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission process. So in 2005, my attorney, remember him, the one I was trying to get the pardon with, so he's from Greensboro also, and there's a representative from Greensboro who's on this bill for this North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission. So he's kind of familiar with what's going on down there, and plus he later becomes elected himself, and so he's, you know, involved in politics. And he tells my dad, he says, get a stack of summaries of Greg's case and go down to the legislature and testify to this committee, because this is what your son needs and this could help, but it has to be passed. And so my dad took a handful of summaries of my case down to the legislature building and didn't need his testimony, because the committee that was going to vote had enough votes already. So my dad is kind of left standing there with this stack of statements, and nobody's heard them. So the representative, I don't know, you know, whatever her motivation was, but she's like, Mr. Taylor, here, let me have those statements. And standing next to her was this guy named Dick Taylor, who's no relation, but he was the president of the North Carolina Academy of Trial Lawyers, as it was known at the time. And so, you know, the poor guy, he just happens to be standing there, and the representative is like, well, here, let's see what he can do with this. So he's probably like, you know, I don't know what to do with these, but I'll take them, I guess. And so a couple of days after that happened, I got an email from this lady named Holly, and I didn't get the email. I got a printout of the email that my dad received, because, of course, we don't have access to any of that stuff. In this email is described that she's the associate of Dick Taylor, and those two go out to eat with Chris Muma and Justice Lake. And, you know, they're talking and they're celebrating that this Innocence Inquiry Commission bill has been passed through committee, and somehow or another, you know, Dick Taylor or somebody, you know, this will probably help this Greg Taylor guy out. And that was when Chris Muma heard my name first. Ironically, as of celebrating a vote on the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission process, she hears my name for the first time and goes back to the office and pulls my questionnaire out of a stack of over 1,000 and starts to work on my case. One thing you'll probably see as you look at innocence cases is that there's most all of them require, or most all of them have, an element of luck involved, and you know, serendipity or whatever. But that was the serendipitous moment in my case in 2005.
Serendipity is defined by Google as the occurrence and development of events by chance in a happy or beneficial way.
So Chris Mumma, the North Carolina Center on Actual Innocence, had my case for almost 2 years and realized there was no way they could get me back into court. So in 2007, she turned my case over to the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission in this process, where this is the only state in the union that has this a commission like this. And it's all about investigating claims of innocence. Some states have conviction integrity units set up through prosecution offices or things like that. But in North Carolina, this is a statewide legislative process that has subpoena power, the power to grant immunity, the power to get prosecutorial records, SBI records, police records, and they do a no stone unturned investigation. And in the end, if they see evidence of innocence, they present it to an 8-member panel. And this 8-member panel consists of like a prosecutor, a defense attorney, law enforcement, victim's advocate, I think a judge, and like a couple of just regular community members. After hearing the evidence that the commission investigators have put together, if they vote in your favor that there's evidence of innocence meriting a judicial review, then it's put in front of a 3-judge panel. So in September of 2009, my case was put in front of an 8-member panel and was voted 8-0 unanimously in my favor that there was evidence of innocence meriting judicial review.
These words were spoken by Yolanda Thomas Littlejohn, Jackie Thomas's sister, at that hearing. I grew up with my sister. I loved her dearly, but I understood who she was. I understood how she lived her life, and it was poor choices that she made that her life ended the way that it did. That didn't make it right for anyone to take her life. I will say, she lived the life that she loved, and she loved the life that she lived. And although it broke all of our hearts for her to die such a tragic death, I have never, ever believed that Mr. Greg Taylor was the one who did this.
Yes, and so I was awarded a hearing in front of a 3-judge panel in February 2010. So, The 3-judge panel, the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry process, I was the third person to go through the 8-member panel, I believe is the way it went. The first person went through the 8-member panel and was denied by the 3 judges, and I think the second person was denied at the 8-member level. And I was the first person to make it through the 8-member panel and then make it through the 3-judge panel. So that makes me kind of historic in modesty.
In the case of State versus Reeves, the commission conducted a hearing on December 14, 2007. The commission voted there was enough evidence for the judicial review. The case was then referred to the 3-judge panel. The 3-judge panel hearing was held in Pitt County on August 25, 2008 through September 3, 2008. The 3-judge panel ruled that Mr. Reeves had not proven his innocence by clear and convincing evidence, and relief was denied. In the case of State versus McNeil, the commission conducted a hearing on January 16th of 2009. The commission unanimously voted that there was not sufficient evidence to merit judicial review. At that time, the investigation was closed.
I mean, I knew, you know, essentially what had to be done according to the law and the burden of proof, you know, that we had to meet and everything, but I didn't really understand the process. And one thing that I did know is that when I left that prison unit to go back to Wake County Jail because I was going to be housed back in Raleigh, you know, to go back and forth to court. I did not want any sort of contact at all with any jailhouse inmates. So they housed me on the mental health floor of Wake County Jail. I know, and that was awful. You know, some of the things you hear and stuff. But at the same time, I didn't have access to newspapers or radio or TV or anything either. So I was basically carried back and forth to court every morning. There was some momentum that was being built up, you know, publicity and news and things like that, that I really wasn't aware of. You know, but the guys, they were basically, I guess they were sheriffs or bailiffs at the regular courthouse. And they were carrying me over to Campbell Law School that had a courtroom that they used for some civil proceedings and stuff. That was my most communication with anybody, was these bailiffs. And, you know, by the time it was, you know, getting winding down to the end of the hearing, you know, they're like, "We're going to go out for hot dogs and lunch. You want anything?" So I was thinking that the worst case scenario is that the world would know that I was innocent and I would get a hot dog out of it. You know, the judges, three of them, the head judge was out of Wake County and the other two were from across the state, and they were impaneled, you know, just for this case. So they sat there, three of them, and, you know, they hear all the evidence and everything that the prosecution can possibly bring up and rebuttal, and, you know, including evidence that they didn't even deem credible enough to put in front of a jury in 93, you know, they were putting up there. The bombshell that fell during the three-judge panel hearings was the SBI blood report. The lab analyst that wrote that report explained that it was SBI procedure, people decided this way above his pay grade, is what he said, and that all he was doing was just following orders, essentially. In the end, the three judges, you know, and the thing about it is they don't tell me, well, first we're going to read his verdict, and then we're going to read her verdict, you know. So I thought after the first verdict, that was it. And then he says, "Be quiet," because the courtroom is like, you know, cheering and stuff. So he says, "Be quiet." And then I was like, "Uh-oh, there's more." And then he reads another verdict, and that's when I was like, "Oh no, that means there's another one."
Here is the audio from the reading of the verdicts from Greg's three-judge panel.
"We are entering the following decision of the three-judge panel pursuant to NCGS 15A-1469, this matter is ready for disposition. The decision: Judge Howard E. Manning Jr. rules that Gregory F. Taylor has proved by clear and convincing evidence that Gregory F. Taylor is innocent, be quiet, of the charge of first-degree murder of Jacquetta Thomas on September 26, 1991. Judge Tanya T. Wallace rules that Gregory F. Taylor has proved by clear and convincing evidence that Gregory F. Taylor is innocent of the charge of first-degree murder of Jacquetta Thomas on September 26, 1991.
You know, there's been a lot of DNA exonerate, or not a lot, but there's been, you know, 300 maybe by now. Maybe there was close to 200 back in 2010. And all those DNA exonerations, well, not all of them, but a lot of them, the outcome of the hearing is already known ahead of time, in that, you know, they've got the DNA, they've got it tested, and this hearing is just a formality to release the person from prison. But I did not know until that third verdict, you know, what was going on or what was going to happen.
And this was the third verdict.
Judge Calvin E. Murphy rules that Gregory F. Taylor has proved by Gregory F. Taylor is innocent of the charge of first-degree murder of Jacquetta Thomas on September 26, 1991. In view of the decision by the panel and pursuant to GS 15A-1469, it is ordered that the release sought by Gregory F. Taylor, the convicted person, is granted, and the charge of first-degree murder of Jaquetta Thomas on September 26, 1991 against Gregory F. Taylor is dismissed, signed this day, February 2010. This matter, this court is now adjourned, sine die.
And after that third verdict, I mean, it was just like all those years of all that frustration and confusion just, you know, just evaporated, and I just shot up out of that chair practically and could have hit the ceiling.
What does a person feel like on day one as a free man after having spent 6,149 days as an innocent man imprisoned?
That minute, I had shackles on my ankles throughout the entire hearing. By the time you wear those shackles for like 9 days straight, practically, I think I had the weekend off, but they started to really rub on the ankles. And so when you walk, you try to walk so that they don't hit you. That makes sense. So they don't move. Yeah. So going back into that room and getting those shackles off and then walking out of that room and then, you know, and hugging my daughter, being free for the first time since she was 9 years old, was everything in the world. It still is.
I asked Greg what came next in the story of Greg Taylor, the exoneree.
I had a daughter and a son-in-law and a grandson, and now I've got grandson number three coming here, and so it's all good, right? I started work in software development about 3 years ago, and so I work as a computer programmer. You know, I like to travel. Maui is one of my favorite spots. It's not, I tell people that my soul's in Maui, but my heart is here. So. I have a sister right now that lives in London. So, yeah, we're all going to England this summer to see her. And I have another brother that lives in Atlanta. And most everybody else lives right here in the Raleigh-Durham, Greensboro area. So we're all pretty close.
I wondered what advice Greg might offer someone who had found themselves in a situation similar to his.
Sometimes the best way is not the easiest way. And it takes a lot of time and a lot of patience. But if you have the truth on your side and you're willing to stick by that truth no matter what, then, you know, maybe you can. It might be a hard road, it might be a long road, but hopefully in the end that truth will prevail. As far as people who have been arrested or convicted, there are certain rights that you have, and it sounds kind of shady almost to say, hey, if you get arrested, don't say one word to the police. But, you know, that's your right to do that, and that's a right that people fought and died for. And one of the reasons why you have that right is because the police aren't necessarily looking for anything from you other than evidence they can use against you. And they can turn everything you say around and make it into something that it's not. Even if you have the truth on your side, it's best not to say anything to the police without an attorney present. I would highly recommend that. The second thing is that nobody's going to know your case better than you do. And always remember that and always make it a point to stay active in your case. And, you know, don't rely on the attorney and the attorney doing all the work. You know, have some sort of a commitment to seeing that the truth prevails. And, you know, from another point of view, you know, sometimes you're just kind of stuck, I guess, with what you might have for representation. But there's probably going to be, you know, certain signs that maybe things aren't going the right way, you know, like your attorney stole all your money and went to prison. Yeah, I mean, you know, sometimes things just, despite everything you try to do, sometimes it's just not going to work out right. And that being the case, I've read close to 1,000 books. I've read the Bible a couple of times. I've read and read and read. And I never could really find anywhere that said, you know, life at that moment was fair. But I really believe that that life, you know, at a point in time might not be fair, but it's how you deal with it that counts. And it's always possible to take a bad situation and make it worse. And on the other side, it's always possible to get just a little something out of it every day, despite how bad it is.
Finally, I asked, what can we, the general public, do to help people who have been wrongly accused and wrongly convicted?
The average listener, I would think, is a potential juror, if nothing else. And as a juror, you have to resist certain instincts. Like, it's highly rational to think that the person sitting at the defense table is guilty. You know, the law says that you're supposed to consider that person innocent until proven guilty, but that's very difficult to do. I would say, you know, take your job as a juror seriously and weigh the credibility of the evidence and not just the content. Consider who says it. If that jailhouse witness has a history of, you know, crimes of deceit, you know, ask yourself, you know, why is this jailhouse witness even on the stand? You know, could this prosecution not make the case without him? You know, so maybe you consider things in the light, you know, without that jailhouse witness. One of the things about exonerations is, and the reason was why they're studied, is because they bring about the causation issues for wrongful convictions, and with lobbying efforts and reform, you hope that, you know, the same mistake doesn't get made, you know, continuously. Saying that, you know, people might think that maybe because of what I've been through or what exonerees have been through. Typically, you're talking about people who believed in the system and maybe believed in the system to, you know, such a stereotypical extent that they believe that the system is infallible. But the fact is that the system is made up of humans. A system made up of humans is going to be prone to human error. And I still believe in the system, but I believe in the system such that, you know, by my own number, I mean, there's a lot of people that I saw in prison that I was glad that they were there, you know, and I believe that the system gets it right in astronomically high percentage of the time. But the times they get it wrong, don't sweep the mistake up under the rug for 20 years, correct it.
I want to thank Greg Taylor for his effort and support in the making of this episode. I would also like to thank Greg's family and team of supporters and all agencies within the Innocent Network for their efforts to free Greg and other innocent people. This is Brooke. Thanks for listening.
Share your feedback and questions by emailing actualinnocencepod@gmail.com. We are also on Twitter at actualinpod. That's at actualinpod. Or search for our page on Facebook. Please show your support by rating us and giving us a good review in iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for listening.